of after Epiphany. We begin with the words of Kayla Mueller. Words smuggled out of Syria many months ago by her cellmates and shared only now with the world by her grieving parents. I have been shown light in darkness. I've learned that even in prison, one can be free. I am grateful. It was through her life and death that I read the two stories before us this morning. Stories that take us to the boundaries, where light shines in the darkness, where the lesser lights of the gods of this world do not avail, where believing begins. The boundaries are not where we live day by day. In fact, most of us do whatever we can to avoid the boundaries. Avoid the leap into the arms of God on the cliff's edge of despair, or the sharp turn in the road leading toward the cross given us to bear. Avoid the dark night of the soul when other helpers fail and comforts flee, or the moment when we must choose between the lie we are living and the truth for which we were born. Instead, we live within reason. When Paul railed against the gods of this world that keep unbelievers from seeing the light of the gospel, I think of the God of the middle way, the safe course, the practical way out, the God who tempts us to live in what Reinhold Niebuhr once characterized as the nicely calculated less and more, where human happiness is determined by the difference between a little more and a little less justice, a little more and a little less freedom, a little more and a little less hope, a little more and a little less truth. It is so self-conscious, Fanny Dillard writes, so apparently moral, simply to step aside from the depths where the creeks and winds pour down, where chariots of fire and horses of fire and clothes dazzling white such as no one on earth could bleach them have been reported. Believing on the boundaries, where in Kayla's words, the only one you really have is God, is simply unreasonable. For Elisha, a legendary prophet to the northern kingdom in the 8th century BC, the boundary of belief is where Elisha's mentor, Elijah, is about to be taken up in a whirlwind into heaven. Elijah tells Elisha three times not to follow him. Stay here, he says, for Elijah must have known that to follow him would be to arrive at this dangerous and holy place where the heavens will split to reveal God's glory. Elisha could have stayed in Gilgal and kept company with the prophets who made their home there. Elisha could have stayed in Bethel, where Abram built a temple and altar to the Lord, where Jacob saw the ladder reaching up to heaven, where Israel's judges built shrines. Elisha could have stayed in Jericho, where the Israelites first crossed over to the land God had promised. Elisha could have spent his life in any one of these thin places, where people tell stories about past encounters with way to God. He accompanies the prophet to the boundary where the heavens open and his father in faith is taken up, leaving Elisha to bear the prophet's mantle until the day he dies. To be sure, most of the Elisha stories that follow are bizarre. Nevertheless, they tell us of a prophet mediating God's power and presence to people in extremis, to people on the boundaries where only God avails. I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was told to stay here during the war, and in fact was encouraged to accept an appointment to the faculty of Union Theological Seminary in New York, among the company of prophets, including Reinhold Niebuhr. But Bonhoeffer resisted the temptation of the gods of this world, refusing to live in the nicely calculated less and more. He returned to Germany, where God's light was made manifest not in the kitsch of Nazi propaganda, but in the incomprehensible darkness of human suffering. I imagine Kayla reading Bonhoeffer's words written from prison a few months before he was hanged. "Human beings," he wrote, "are summoned to share in God's sufferings at the hands of a godless world. It is not the religious act that makes the Christian, but participation in the sufferings of God in the secular life. I'm still discovering right up to this moment that it is only by living completely in this world that one learns to have faith, throwing ourselves completely into the arms of God, taking seriously not our own sufferings, but those of God in the world. That, I think, is faith." Yet in the middle of Mark's gospel, at the boundary between Jesus' public ministry and his passion, just before the turn he takes toward Jerusalem and the cross, the suffering of God's Son is precisely what the disciples could not fathom. Mark begins the strange story of the Transfiguration with words that require a backward glance. 6 days later, he writes, 6 days after Jesus had asked his disciples who people said that he was, 6 days after they answered John the Baptist and Elijah and one of the prophets, 6 days after Peter answered, "You are the Messiah," and Jesus ordered him to tell no one. But most significantly, 6 days after Jesus began to teach them that he must undergo great suffering and be rejected and killed, and after 3 days rise again. 6 days after Peter rebuked Jesus for this teaching, refusing to hear of Jesus' suffering and by implication of his own. That is, of his own suffering if Peter were to follow him. 6 days after Jesus rebuked Peter, saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things, setting your mind on the God of this world." 6 days later, God's glory is made manifest on the mountaintop. is hard to see the glory of God when you are standing in the spotlight. Yet in another way, you can understand Peter's confusion. Until this moment in Mark's gospel, Peter had witnessed a multitude of healings, an exorcism or two, Jesus twice commanding the wind and the waves to obey him, a child brought back from the dead, 5,000 and then 4,000 miraculously fed, a teacher who had authority like no other. Given the evidence, Peter must have believed very reasonably that he was in the company of the one whom God had sent to restore the fortunes of God's people, and by extension, Peter's own. He must have imagined life with Jesus to be pure light with no darkness at all, the road ahead. All good. Until Jesus said, in response to his confession, "I am going the way of suffering and death." Therefore Jesus said, now speaking to the crowd, "If anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it." Unlike Elijah, who commanded Elisha to stay in the safety of Gilgal and Bethel and Jericho, wanting to shield him from the dangerous and holy boundary where the heavens split to reveal God's glory, Jesus says, "Leave the calculated less and more, and follow me through suffering and death to live the life no grave can contain." 6 days later, Mark continues, Jesus leads Peter and James and John to a high mountain in a three-story understanding of the universe. That is the place between heaven and earth, between God's dwelling place and our own, between eternity and time. He led them up to a high mountain. When Mark says that Jesus was transfigured before them and his clothes were dazzling white such as no one could ever reach them, he is pushing words to their boundaries. In the gospel that ends, as we will see on Easter morning, with the women running away, terrified from the empty tomb, saying nothing to anyone, the transfiguration is as close as we get in Mark's gospel to a resurrection appearance. I imagine it was a story that Jesus' followers carried with them into the Colosseum as they faced the lions in Rome, and on to the crosses where they would be nailed and set up around Jerusalem. A story they told in the jail cells of Ephesus and Rome and Birmingham. And later, a story one preacher told himself in a cell in Flossenbürg before he emerged to walk to his death at the end of a noose. A story told even now by believers in God who are held by ISIS, young men and women who quit their reasonable lives to seek God in the faces of the suffering. Some people find God in church, Kayla wrote to her father in 2011, on his birthday. Some people find God in nature. Some people find God in love. I find God in suffering. I've known for some time what my life work is, using my hand to love and serve. There is no doubt that her belief in the God who met her on the boundary of human suffering freed Kayla Mueller to live as though death had no dominion. My friends, believing on the boundaries has nothing to do with believing three impossible things about God before breakfast. Faith. Faith is the gift of a meeting that is more often than not given to those whose lives have been placed on the boundary between life and death, heaven and earth, eternity and time. There are times in every life, poet Christian Wyman writes, in the face of the boundary that is his own terminal illness, times in every life when one is overwhelmed by reality spilling its boundaries. It can happen when you fall in love, or after the early nullifying horror abates a bit, when the world turns sharper and starker after a dire diagnosis. It can happen in Syria, in captivity. I have come to a place and experience where, in every sense of the word, I have surrendered myself to our Creator, because literally, there was no one else, Kayla wrote. And by God and by your prayers, I felt tenderly cradled in free fall. I have been shown light in darkness. Believing on the boundaries, it is the gift of a meeting in which we become free to hear the word of grace that God has spoken in Jesus Christ in such a way that, in spite of all that contradicts it, we may once for all, exclusively and entirely, hold to God's promise